Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. All right, here we go. You're in charge for the first half hour. We're going to open up the phones, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can discuss whatever you'd like. You can email me, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can share your favorite Vermont State Park. We had Nate McKean from the State Parks yesterday. I'd love to hear places you love to go around the state, concerts you'll be attending, any clues on how to keep cool in this oppressive heat. I think it was Satchel Paige used to say, or maybe, oh, it may have been Cool Papa Bell. One of the old Negro League players used to say, just think cool thoughts. I think that'll do it. That'll bring that core temperature down. We talked F-35s yesterday. We can talk about them. Do you live near the airport? What have you heard? Are the F-35s much louder in your estimation than the F-16s, their predecessors? Does it make much of a difference? You can let us know. We talked Euro soccer competition. Have you been watching? Are you happy or not about England's 2-0 defeat yesterday? 2-0. They beat Germany. And who's your favorites to win it all? We're at 244-1777. 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK is our toll-free number. We had a caller yesterday, big Habs fan, and he wished we talked about the great run the Canadians are on during this year's Stanley Cup playoffs. Says we're not talking about them enough. I think he's right. You know, we give the scores. We do talk about Dominic Ducharme, former UVM player, coaching him. But, you know, we haven't had a ton on about them. I tried to get a Montreal Gazette writer on this morning, but to no avail, unfortunately. I know they're knee-deep in the series right now and probably covering that like crazy. But I'll do my best if you want to talk Canadians. I do follow the NHL. I follow the Habs because they're our close neighbors. I've gone up for a few matches at the Bell Center. Unfortunately, never been to the Forum. If you've been and you want to tell us about what that was like, I heard it was a great arena to watch hockey. Again, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. We have the Duke of Newbury batting leadoff today, Fred. Duke, how are you?
All right. The Duke's doing fine.
All right, that's great to hear. All right, what are your thoughts today?
Okay, my thoughts today are you know, the so-called insurrection.
Yeah, the storming of the Capitol on January 6th.
Yeah, the storming
which
of
we
the
all
Capitol,
saw.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was thinking about the insurrection and what an insurrection is and what would really cause an insurrection. I came to the conclusion that if the federal government, including the Supreme Court, agreed that AR-15s should be banned from manufacture, sale, and possession, I think that would cause an insurrection.
Is that what caused January 6th? Because I'm a little confused,
no,
Fred.
No, it's not what caused January 6th.
Okay.
What I'm saying, if you want to cause an insurrection, just ban AR-15s and you can't manufacture them anymore and you can't possess them. And so the government's going to say, we'll buy them back. Okay. You can't buy them back because at the going price, because if you can't manufacture any of them, then there's no going price. The only price out there is the whatever the person that owns an AR-15 is willing to sell it for. And that would be the going price. And there's something like 10 million AR-15s in private hands. That would never happen. And I can almost guarantee the U.S. military would not knock on doors collecting AR-15s.
That's right. All right. You got your radio on. You're getting a lot of feedback loop there, I think. Bring Fred out, unfortunately. The Duke's having a little audio problems this morning. And, I'm not sure. That's Fred's point. Take away the AR-15s, ban them, buy them back, and you'll have an insurrection. That didn't happen on January 6th. The insurrection happened because a group of people believed and that the election in November was wrong, was flawed, and they didn't want the results to be certified. And we're now heading into July. It's a long time, 8 months, to find where the problem was with November's election, and I haven't seen it yet. So let's not have any more insurrections over AR-15s or election results. Let's be in a mode of healing and speaking to one another and accepting when election results are certified, that we accept that and we move on. All right? Because what we saw on January 6th, Fred, you seem sometimes to not believe that that actually happened. We watched it unfold. It was an insurrection. It happened at our Capitol. Americans stormed the Capitol. They disrespected police officers, which I can't abide for any reason. We've got problems on, sometimes with police officers, but when you're in a position to respond to a police officer, do what they say first. And then let's try to move on from that. Some go beyond, and that's wrong. We can't have that, but we're working on that in this country. That insurrection that we saw January 6th, I can find no justification for what happened that day. It still shakes me to the core, what I watched unfold that particular day. All right. We are at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. What else do you want to talk about? I will tell you that, I've been asking what concerts are you going to get out to. I have now purchased a ticket. July 31st, there's something called Chet Fest, and it's going on at the Wayside Farm in Randolph Center. The organic dairy farm owned by Chester Abbott. And on that day, the Bothera Band and No Small Children will be performing. No Small Children are three female school teachers, I think from California, and they'll be playing. So the name kind of refers to, there's no school children when they get out and play their rock and roll. So it's kind of a neat show that I will be attending, probably the first real out-and-out concert that I'll get to since last March. As a matter of fact, right before things shut down, I was at a concert back in Allentown, Pennsylvania. And on the drive home that night, there was the announcement that the NBA was shutting down, and then the world shut down because all of a sudden we knew that COVID had really taken hold here in the United States and around the world. And hopefully we're seeing the back of it. We'll get some numbers from Bob Ney, a national correspondent, when he calls in at 9:30. It's not behind us completely. Vermont, it feels like it always feels like we're a little bit apart from the rest of the world in some things, and in this, going over 81% vaccinated is a real benchmark. But there are parts of the country where the numbers are much, much lower of individuals being vaccinated. How do you move on if the one thing you have right now, I guess you could still wear a mask, still socially distance. But the vaccination, takes away those things, and you can go back to as close to a normal life as possible. And you have problems rolling up your sleeve and taking the vaccination? I'd love to hear why. We heard about Ellie Perrier-St-Pierre last week, and we'll be talking with Olympic rugby player Alona Marr from Burlington at 10:30. Are the Olympics still a big deal for you? When I was a kid in my neighborhood, we would huddle around a television to watch the winter and summer games, and then we'd have our own competitions throughout the neighborhood. We made our own medals. It was just absolutely a big time for us, and we loved it so much. But Olympics coming up in Japan, they're going to captivate you. You can call us with your thoughts or stories, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, VTViewpoint at RadioVermont.com. And we're going to Montpelier, and Jerry is next. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. How's it going?
Good. How you doing?
I'm not bad. I'm a little less serious now.
Yes.
The capital thing made me sick to my stomach. But let's get by that. number one, Tampa Bay versus Canadians.
Yes.
I have family that are avid Canadian fans.
Mm-hmm.
I have friends that are avid Canadian fans. And I'm a Bruins fan, so
uh-oh,
that isn't... Well, it's like being Red Sox and Yankees,
that's,
you know?
Right. That's absolutely right.
And the trouble is the Canadians have done well to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Their top two coaches, the top coach and the one that's coaching right now until Friday night,
right,
is because of the COVID.
Mm-hmm.
They both went to UVM and played hockey there together.
Yeah,
so that's pretty cool.
It is cool.
Now the other thing that you don't hear about is a player from Tampa Bay. And by the way, I'm a Tampa Bay fan.
Oh my gosh!
Also,
how about that?
Well,
all right. No, that's
it's
cool.
Because the first national hockey game, I'm 66 years old,
uh-huh,
been involved in hockey all my life. And the first National Hockey League game I saw was last year in Tampa Bay. So it was pretty cool. So they have a place in my heart. But there's a guy on the team that plays for them named Ross Colton. And he's also a UVM player. He's from UVM, so
Lightning.
People, you know, yeah, Ross Colton.
Yeah, well, so, and of course they had Martin Saint-Louis for a while too down there, another UVM grad. With the Tampa Bay Lightning. Well, Jerry, you bring up a good point. I've been to one Tampa Bay Lightning game when I lived down there, and went with a couple guys from Toronto, and you know, the one thing of hockey in the Sun Belt, it feels a little odd. I've gone to Florida Panthers games as well, right? And you think, okay, you know, it's they don't get it. But I will say, and this was before the Lightning won their first Stanley Cup. It was back, a good 20-some years ago. And being around those fans, I felt they got it. I felt they were really embracing hockey long before they had a team that's as dominant as they are now. So
I'll tell you, my friends wouldn't let me wear my Boston Bruins hat in the arena. They thought I would get in trouble, but I didn't, and I didn't get in trouble. It was a great game. They won it, and you know, they had a great game the other night.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens tonight and move forward from there. It's going to be a great series. I hope it goes seven.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you, one of the greatest things I've seen too since I've been here, in Vermont was there was a playoff series between the Habs and the Bruins. And, I was driving down towards Boston and it was probably, for a Sox game because it would have been, you know, baseball season already. And the amount of Canadiens fans that were heading towards Boston that day, flags flying, you know, the rivalry does exist. And like you said, it is like Yankees Red Sox here, a good, pretty even split between Bees fans and Habs fans. And it's a great rivalry, and it's great when they can, when they match up and play in a series in the Stanley Cup.
Let's just say I really, really, really dislike the Yankees, and I really, really, really dislike the Canadiens. That's all I'm not going to say. I'm not going to use the word hate.
Yeah.
But can I move on to my next subject?
Go
and
ahead.
Then I'm just going to let you talk about it.
All right. Thanks, Jerry.
And maybe a caller coming in.
All right.
I've lived in Montpelier all my life, 66 years, like I said.
Mm-hmm.
I am extremely, extremely disappointed that there is no July 4th celebration, including fireworks. I don't know why they couldn't do fireworks.
Mm.
They knew that the governor was going to let things, you know, open up on July 4th.
Right.
And we've done well with the vaccinations. We're up to 81 or 2% now.
You're right.
Which is amazing. Way to go, Vermonters.
Right.
So I'm going to let you talk about it, but I'm not happy about it. And Montpelier has changed. I'll tell you something. Yesterday, I brought this up to somebody that lives in my apartment house. And I said, why? You know, what's the reason? I said, I know that Montpelier has changed over the years. And believe me, it has. And we won't get into that one right now.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he actually believes that they don't want to pay tribute to America
this
year.
Jerry, that I'm going to say is probably wrong. All right.
Well, I hope so.
I don't know what the motivation is. And, you know, I'm going to try to find what I can for you. But that's someone surmising.
No.
Right. And
I agree.
And we're not going to dignify that because.
No, take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
In one ear and out the other.
You got it.
I don't believe it's that either. I'm sure it has something to do with the pandemic.
Right.
But, gee whiz, you know, fireworks?
All right. So let me see.
I don't know.
What I can find. Now, there is a celebration on the State House lawn. On July 3rd from 5 to 8. This is 2021. And,
are they having fireworks?
I don't
know. Have they changed
it? I'll try to find as much as I can. But let's just talk about that. If anyone knows what's going on in Montpelier, and Jerry, I know a lot of places had to make decisions and order fireworks and things like that and make all the provisions. We did get a heads up, pretty far out from the governor that July 4th, we would definitely be reopened here in the state because of the vaccination rates. I can't speak for Montpelier of why they are or aren't having events. I just found something that says there's some kind of event going on in the State House lawn from 5 to 8 this Saturday. I will also tell you that being in Montpelier and there at the Capitol and watching the fireworks displays is a great way to celebrate the 4th of July and honor this country. I think your friend, you know, has certainly made a point that's talking out of school. I don't think that's
I agree. I just wanted to give you somebody's opinion and someone's intake. It's not mine. I'll let you go and listen to your information.
Okay. Thanks, Jerry. VT Digger.
Happy July 4th.
All right. You too. Have a great one. It does say, Danny found that VT Digger on the 28th said that, now that's off my screen, but organizers learned of the state's lifting of the COVID-19 precautions only 2 weeks ago. that's when it became official. I know we were hoping to have earlier announcements of that. And so, you know, that probably is why they felt a little hamstrung and couldn't pivot quickly enough in Montpelier. I think the event that I found on the Statehouse lawn is definitely not the big 4th of July celebration that Jerry's referring to. If anyone knows more about why Montpelier isn't and can't, that's unfortunate. It does take months of planning. It is a big deal. You don't want to throw together, you know, the fireworks display without the proper precautions. I think you also have to have the fire department's approval, et cetera. It does take a lot of oversight. And so apparently Montpelier probably couldn't pivot quickly enough, and that's unfortunate. But there are plenty in other places, and hopefully people will get out to those. You know, when I think of regulations and oversight, I think right now of the folks in Surfside, Florida, right? We don't want a lot of regulations. We don't want a lot of oversight. We want to do what we want to do, and I get that, right? That's our nature. We are in a free country because of that, but when you look at what happened at that condominium in Surfside, Florida, I used to go to a beach just maybe a half mile north of where that occurred. You're finding out now there were problems, and they were known about, and nothing was done over a period of several years. And then all of a sudden, last week we had the collapse of that condominium, and I think the body count, 12 people now. And, you know, when you always hear a number and it always seems to rise, people have died because of that. So, you know, you don't want to take shortcuts with something like fireworks, too. I'm not trying to defend the decision of the city of Montpelier. I don't know the full reasoning, but it looks like that might have been the case. The Capitol is just one of the many communities that, facing long expired deadlines to raise money and finalize permits, announced this spring they wouldn't hold the traditional parades and fireworks, is another thing that Danny is sending me that he's found. So, yeah, it does take planning and money, and unfortunately that wasn't able to be done in time because of this pandemic. 2021, better than 2020, but some things we're still missing. That's unfortunate. All right, let's wrap up the open phones for today. Thanks, Jerry. Very gave us a lot to think about.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'll be taking the next 2 days off, and you'll have Pat McDonald and Rusty DeWeese as your celebrity guest hosts on Thursday and Friday. So rather than Friday, we have national correspondent Bob Ney joining us today with an update and insights into what's happening in the world. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Bob, let's start with the numbers, the COVID numbers.
Well, this week, and of course you do this every week, which I think is great to point out where we're at. Mm-hmm. Total deaths in the United States are 604,394. Total deaths globally are 3,932,925. Now, if we put this in kind of a perspective, the last 7 days' death statistics, 7-day average was 287 deaths was the average. Now, that was actually, excuse me, up a little bit, plus 5.2, but basically the, you know, the deaths are not skyrocketing where they once were. Now, there's a lot of talk, though, about, you know, the Delta strain and the Super Delta strain, and not enough people are yet vaccinated, and, you know, California's having some issues pop up in some individual states, but in general, it has tended to obviously level off.
All right, and we can only hope it continues to do so.
I hope.
And Bob, what's the story about a vaccine causing a rare heart inflammation problem.
Right. This story, of course, was released by the Center for Disease Control, and it did conclude yesterday, actually it's just concluding today, this morning, that there's a likely association between heart inflammation and the COVID-19 mRNA vaccines, especially in adolescents and young adults. But what they're saying is they still see a clear benefit for the group to get the shots, you know, especially young adults. Mm-hmm. And it's identified, the CDC did, 12.6 cases per million second doses of this vaccine in 21 days following the vaccine. They've studied, you know, those cases. 309 out of, 323 were hospitalized. 295 of those were discharged, and 9 remain in the hospital with 2 in the intensive care units. And again, these are mainly younger people we're talking about. So obviously, you know, for some people, this is going to add a lot of debate to it. 600-some thousand younger people have been vaccinated. When I say younger, this is the, you know, 17 and below age groups to 12.
All right. We'll move on from that, and let's go to what's happening in the House, a House bill to investigate the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, Rick, this bill, I mean, it's actually going to be a House-only bill. It just amazes me how they got to this point in the sense that originally, since January 6th, they tried to pass a bill through the House, the Senate, to be signed by the president to establish a commission. Mm-hmm. Now they're going back to what they could have done in the first place, frankly, which was a House measure. You approve it by the House, and you do it. I'm not even sure it actually needed House approval. It could probably have been done by House Administration. I used to chair the committee. We could create select committees. Mm-hmm. But they're going to put it through the process. They probably should have done this a long time ago instead of having to, you know, how many months now? Multiple months about is this politicized or not. We'll see how the Republicans will participate in it. But the main thrust of this, and some of the conservative, by the way, conservative Republicans are supporting this, because the idea is get down to the bottom of the security concerns. Once you get past the arguments of President Trump,
right,
you know, did he or didn't he, get to the security concerns, because there are, you know, over, well, when I was there, at least 10,000 some staff people and people that work in that building, including the media in the surrounding complex, that, you know, they want to go home to their families at night. So I think, you know, hopefully it'll stay to that point at the end of it.
Absolutely. And that is the important point of what needs to be learned. All right. This is very interesting. Coming up, I think in August, there's going to be 4 emergency shelters for migrant children closing. Is that a good idea? Is that something that should happen?
Well, the Biden administration is going to be closing them. I mean, this might have been a story somebody might have said, well, that was the last administration, but it's the Biden administration that's going to shut down the 4 emergency shelters. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, there's record numbers of migrant children, more are arriving at the southern border. So they're going to close the shelters. It's Texas, and I think there's the California Convention Centers. Mm-hmm. And you're right, by August, they're going to do it. And what they're going to do is to force the issue then of the children rather than going into these facilities. They're going to be sent to relatives in the United States or to, quote, state-licensed shelters, which would mean that the burden will then go down to, you know, all of the states to see where the kids will be placed. Now, you can bet, though, I'm just going to predict to this, you know, predict this issue because this happened in Tennessee. Some of the kids coming in the southern border may end up in other states.
Right.
They may end up in Ohio. They may end up in Vermont. You know, who knows where they will end up. Depends on placements and, you know, are there shelter settings in these states? Some of our children's homes, we used to call them, have been done away with in Ohio.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, I agree. I think that's exactly what we're going to see, and I don't know if that's the best avenue.
Oh, it'll stir debate, I guarantee you, as debate. Kids are going to other states.
We'll be talking about this again in August if that comes
up. All right.
Yeah. All right. Very interesting decision by the Supreme Court on evictions, the ban on evictions.
Right. You know, Rick, if this continues, I don't know if they have to debate adding more members or not.
That's right. You're right.
Seriously. I mean, there's been a couple of decisions, you know, recently that you're like, okay.
Who is this court? I agree with
right.
you.
Right. Where are they coming from? Maybe we don't need to add if, you know, you're looking at that end of it.
Right.
But it voted 5-4 on Tuesday night to leave in place the Center for Disease Control. They have a ban on evictions, and it's to come back, you know, during the pandemic and to prevent homelessness and other problems. So the ban's been extended for another month, which I think is kind of smart. They're doing it month by month versus we'll do it for a year,
right.
you know. But a group of landlords, of course, understandable, real estate companies, real estate trade associations in Alabama and Georgia convinced a U.S. judge, and, you know, you can kind of judge pick, as they say, in the spring that the Center for Disease Control really lacked authority to have this moratorium. That's what they convinced this Judge Dabney Friedrich of. But now, considered by the Supreme Court, Justice John Roberts joined conservatives Brent Kavanaugh and liberal justices Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Ilana Kagan to keep it in place. Justices Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Amy Comet Barrett said they would have lifted the stay. So you kind of really had a big-time bipartisan decision on that one. So it'll stay in place another month, you know, that the CDC is having this moratorium of not having evictions.
A big concern nationally is the amount of jobs right now that are going unfilled and why people aren't seeking jobs. What are you finding, Bob?
Well, I'll give you what they're telling in the story, and I'll kind of give you a personal observation if I could, because
sure.
it's been frustrating up here. But there's around 10 million unemployed Americans and about 9 million open positions right now that are open. But a lot of people aren't seeking the jobs. This is the first time, really probably in decades, that workers kind of can sit back and say, well, wait a minute, let me see if I want to do that. So about 10% of the job seekers say they're actively looking for it, just 10%. This is according to a new survey, you know, that they, you know, ask around the country through the job resources. And about 45% are passively looking for jobs, and 30% plan to get a job in the near future, but they're not going to look right now. So a lot of jobs are still open in low-wage areas, what service industry, although a lot of those jobs I saw at Bob Evans the other day. Do you have a Bob Evans?
Not here, no. I miss him. I used to live out in Ohio. I'd love for...
Yeah, I know you. I figured you would, Rick, I figured you would know what a Bob Evans is.
Great breakfast.
It's a great breakfast. And I took my dad there the other day, and they had a sign that said, sign up, come work for us, we're going to give you $300 cash. And I thought, okay. And then I asked what the wages were, and some people said, well, it's like $12. So it says lower wages, which that's not the most wages in the world, but it's higher than it used to be, let me put it that way.
Right.
So a lot of people are not seeking jobs, you know, in that area. And then child care is another major factor.
Right.
So we think that as states are canceling unemployment, which Ohio has done, the extra unemployment, it's done that. And as kids go back to school in the fall, and, you know, parents are able to have a little bit of time freed up, then maybe the job market will alter a little bit. On a personal level, I went to the homeless shelter here yesterday. And I'm helping a friend doing a rehab of a home in a lake area. And I went there the day before, actually, the night before, and I offered, you know, $17 an hour. I pay cash, I will pick them up, and I will buy lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one taker.
Mm.
And I'm not trying to stereotype here. I have been trying to seek, you know, people to do some work. It's tough.
Yeah.
Either they have a lot of options, and I'm not saying that they're just sitting not going to work, but there's either a lot of options out there, or I have a couple of friends who told me they're not going to, until their unemployment runs out, they're not going to do anything, you know, on some of these job sites. So just throwing that out there that there's multiple issues. I'm not trying to say it's one.
No.
But there's definitely something that's changed a lot here when it comes to the job market.
It definitely has to now swing back the other way.
Right. I think it will.
Yeah. There were protections put in place, and sometimes they linger just a little bit too long.
A little too long.
Right.
Exactly.
And then it has to go the other way. So I totally agree. National correspondent Bob Ney, Love when you call us. Thanks for spending time with us again.
Thank you, Rick. Enjoy your couple of days there.
All right, thanks. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. With me now is Sally Pollock of 7 Days. This week is the cartoon issue of 7 Days, and Sally still had to report a story, but it was then told in cartoon form. She got to go out day tripping with Guster's Ryan Miller, hitting a bunch of my favorite Vermont spots, and she's here to tell us all about it. Sally, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hello.
Hello there. Okay, what is the quest that Ryan Miller is going on right now?
So Ryan Miller has a sort of project, and people can read it online at weirdandwonderfulworld.com, and it is to take little trips, day trips around Vermont and discover interesting, unusual, weird, and wonderful places.
And who charted this trip that you went on?
He charted it, and then so three of us went on this trip. It was Ryan, me, and Michael Tan, who's a Burlington artist, and Michael did all the illustrations and artwork, and I wrote a little story, and then Ryan was sort of the ringleader, although we did kind of improv, shall we say.
Yep.
But it was really Ryan's trip, and we were along, and it was a blast.
Yeah, what was the first stop on the trip?
The first stop, of course, was coffee, because we're, reporters and musicians and artists, not up and at 'em. And so we went to the Jericho Center country store for coffee and then took off from there up into the Northeast Kingdom. And I think the second stop, Michael grew up in Underhill. So the second stop was a view he took us to of Mount Mansfield. It's just a fantastic view of Mount Mansfield.
Well, you kind of skip by that country store a little quickly. That is a real gem. That's one of my favorites in the state, and it's not far from where Wilson Snowflake Bentley grew up.
Right. It is a real gem, and the reason I skipped by it is because we went to about 20 places after that, but I can tell you, you walk in, and first of all, it just looks fantastic, as you know. I mean, it's a real genuine spot.
Yep.
But also, I know you would like this, it smelled of bacon, so even though we only got, me and Ryan only got coffee, it was just like very tempting to dig into more food. But and then we sort of sipped our coffee a little bit on the green before getting in and driving on.
Penny candy, great cookies baked there. You stopped at the Vermont International Museum of Contemporary Art. Tell us about that.
This is a neat little place that I never knew about. It's in Eden, and it's sort of run by an artist and an art teacher and a media video teacher named Matt Neckers. Mm-hmm. And it's got several components. It's outside the home where Matt lives with his family, and his kids also sort of gave us a tour. And there's the main gallery is a trailer that he rescued or dislodged from the Montgomery woods and hauled to his backyard. And it's got, and you can contribute to it. In fact, Ryan left a guitar pick, one-of-a-kind guitar pick. If you want to see it, I recommend you go to that museum. And Matt builds, among other things, he makes rockets. So yep. There are some rockets there that he's made and welded. And there's little, beautiful little canvases in the trailer part of the museum, and it's kind of a workshop where you'll find all sorts of interesting things.
He is an interesting cat. And then took you to the asbestos mine nearby.
Yep, we all went on, I guess you'd say, a little field trip to the asbestos mine. They joined us. Matt and his two kids joined us. And I never knew Vermont had an inactive asbestos mine, but it does. And it's quite a sight, actually. It's just tailings, I guess, from the mine, and you can see sort of a building that's no longer active, but a big sort of skeletal structure and tracks up the kind of mountain and "Do Not Enter" sign. And then from there we went to, I think the next stop was the Siskoy Lanes, the bowling alley in Lowell. where we're sort of, I'd say at that point, we were in the kingdom, and we didn't bowl, nor did we buy eggs, but we could have.
Could have done both.
Neat spot. Yeah, could have done both.
That's
but
right.
We had a lot to see and do.
Well, you went to the Glover Metroplex, my favorite. Tell us about your stops there.
Well, we went to, we ate a big pepperoni and onion pizza at Parker Pie outside, and then we went to the Bread and Puppet Museum, which is, you know, everyone in the world should go to the Bread and Puppet Museum.
Yep.
And from there, we went to yet another museum. There, you know, you can be in the Northeast Kingdom and museum hop.
That's right.
We went to the Museum of
You could be in
life.
Glover and museum
and
hop.
That's absolutely right. And we did museum hop in Glover. And there, one of the exhibits is about knots. And so there, as part of that exhibit, there's a rope swing hanging from the rafters that Ryan swung on. In fact, all three of us swung on it. And it's kind of like announcing your arrival because it's a bit creaky.
Yeah.
But that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's the Museum of Everyday Life. As you're leaving Glover, it's the great last stop before you get out of town. Every year, everyday item is the theme. Now, Sally, this is different. It's a cartoon story, as you said, and you had a cartoon artist with you. But how do you write a cartoon story, which is different from normal reporting?
Yeah, that was really interesting and fun for me, a big change. Well, you don't do what I did the first draft. Which was write, a few sentences and maybe a paragraph for each little scene. And the editor who kindly said, good start, Sally. in other words, make it like a line. So you really have to, for instance, we went, all credit to Michael, who, really tells the story in these incredible illustrations in color. And I just sort of give little snippets of info and dialogue. I took notes as I would on any story. So I, was able to quote people. And so sometimes there's little, speech bubbles. But for instance, I don't know if you've ever been to Brownington, to the Old Stonehouse Museum, yet another museum in the Northeast Kingdom that was built by Alexander Twilight. And for that panel, the text is just, the Twilight Zone. So that kind of thing. And then, it's elaborated in the drawing. And so that was really fun for me. I really enjoyed it. It just is a new way to tell a story. And,
all right.
And it was also just a neat to collaborate, with an artist.
And
so.
Quick question. We're almost out of time. Did you have to listen to Guster the whole time you were driving around with Ryan?
I thought about that coming back. We talked. We did not play music on that trip.
Yep.
We were driving. We were gone for like 10 hours. And a 10-hour road trip, of course, getting out and looking at things and hanging out. But all three of us had so much to say that we just talked.
Love it. Oh,
we didn't even
ride.
Hum a tune. But I would like to say one thing. It's weird, wonderful .world .com. So if anyone wants to check out Ryan's musings on day tripping in Vermont, it's weirdwonderful.world.
All right. You can read Sally Pollock's story in this week's 7 Days or online at 7daysvt.com. Sally, thanks for being on with us this morning.
Thanks. It was fun. Talk to you later.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. All right. News now and then back with more Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. The pandemic has been like some bizarre time warp. All of a sudden it started. We thought we'd only have to behave for a few weeks or a month. The number of COVID case counts and deaths start to escalate. And even when it looked like the numbers were dropping, they'd rise again. Variants developed. And then we finally got vaccines approved and distributed. But the length of the pandemic, which in truth is really going on in some states and countries that aren't sufficiently vaccinated, has really taken its toll on people in different ways. Seamus McAvoy of VT Digger has written about those effects in several recent stories. He joins us now to talk about them. Seamus, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks a lot, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Seamus about his stories, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, or you can tell us how the pandemic did affect you as well. I want to talk about the first story, which talked about changes people went through, Seamus. What are the ways that people have kind of reevaluated their lives due to this pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this story sort of came out of a simple question that was pretty difficult to answer. You know, I mean, we've been covering the ways the pandemic has been changing our world, but how did it change us, you know, from an interior, you know, type of point of view? And I don't think I'm being humble in admitting, you know, the article doesn't quite get to everything. And really, that's one of the lessons here, is that it's impossible to capture just the vast spectrum of experiences people have had. But it still makes for, you know, a pretty useful North Star for our coverage moving forward and tracking how people have changed. And really, it comes down to every aspect of people's lives. I mean, people change their careers. Some people worked in new hobbies into their routines, perhaps practicing more mindfulness techniques, be it, you know, gardening, exercise, getting out into nature more often, baking bread. We know that was an early pandemic trend that some people have kept up with. I spoke with one Vermont resident who got into making bread for her skiing community that she goes out with. And when we were speaking, she said she didn't even realize that part of the benefit of it was just being able to keep in touch with people that way and do something, kind of an act of service for others that helped, you know, strengthen the bond through friendships that certainly were strained in a remote world. And I think, you know, we wondered when the pandemic began, and once we saw the severity of it, whether or not people would be, you know, motivated to change something about their lives. And for many people, that ended up being the case.
And why? You know, granted, it was a major disruption to our lives for over a year. Now that I say that, it seems really massive. But why did this cause such major decisions and shifts in people's lives?
Yeah, I mean, it's unlike anything anyone alive now has really lived through. Mm-hmm. I think some cases it was necessitated. I spoke with one resident, Lindsay Toy, and she's from Hyde Park. She had been working as an office manager in Stowe before the pandemic. But when that office closed down, she actually lost her job, and some of the changes due to the pandemic and that remote field didn't quite work for her. So she was left to sort of adapt to that new scenario. She had always wanted to be an art maker or an artist, and had been experimenting making candles for her friends for Christmas presents and things like that. And she ended up turning that into a full-time business. She now operates farmers market stands in Jericho and runs an Instagram page that has also been doing well, a TikTok page that has been doing well. She still walks dogs up in Stowe to kind of supplement the income. But in that case, it sort of came out of necessity. You look at another case like Kathleen Hoffman. She was an English teacher at Missisquoi Valley Union School in Swanton, lived in St. Albans. And for her, it was kind of the downtime she needed to reevaluate what she wanted to do with her life. She's in her 50s now and has been teaching for over 30 years. And seeing the way the remote schooling was going to be going in the future, seeing having concerns over the way the pension plan might be being tweaked by the legislature, she decided, you know what, it's time for a change to do something that I've always wanted to do. So she's sold her house, she's going to be selling her car, and she's going to be moving to Spain to go teach, instead of English literature to high school kids, she's going to be teaching English as a foreign language. So she'll be moving to Madrid in September to embark on that next step. totally by herself. She's got a daughter that goes to school, college here in Vermont. But just such a radical change that I think, she said came down to, having that time to reflect and really take that moment to think about what she really wanted to do.
Yeah, that is really, in this story, the one that really stands out. And I could just see her daughter when she goes to her and says, yeah, I'm moving to Madrid. And the daughter, mom, what?
It might make visiting, visiting parents a little bit more palatable if you're going to Madrid. So I think she's excited about that. And, certainly her friends as well. Once they got over the shock that she was actually going to be moving across the ocean, I think they're pretty excited for her as well.
Madrid.
So she's nervous. She said she had that, oh my God, what am I doing moment, particularly when she saw that her insurance was going to be expiring at the end of the month. The plan was going to run up. And that can really be, it's one thing to say it, but then to see, it in action is something else entirely. But she's feeling positive. She mentioned she was thinking about her father, who actually, when he passed, was a year younger than she is now. And she said he never got to see the world the way she has. She's been able to travel to Europe in the past. And so part of it, it's for herself, but also, in his memory as well. And just realizing the importance of today, because tomorrow isn't guaranteed.
And Madrid is a vibrant, wonderful city, and she's going to love it. So more power to her. What were the mental health effects that the pandemic has had on people?
Yeah, there's really no shortage here. It's been vast, and it's affected people of all ages from all different backgrounds. I was speaking with Julie Balaban, who's an assistant professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at Dartmouth Geisel School of Medicine. This was about 3 weeks ago now, but when she was looking at it, it was on a Monday. There were 33 people in the state of New Hampshire waiting for a hospital bed, and 31 of those were children. So we do know that there's a shortage of psychiatric beds in Vermont, and that's something that's happening around the country. I was chatting with Paul Foxman, who's a founding director of the Vermont Center for Anxiety Care in Burlington, and he said the pandemic has really precipitated an explosion in anxiety and related mental health issues. There's been so much confusion on mask wearing, on infections of the disease, on the vaccines, mixed messages on the efficacy of the vaccines. I mean, I really think we need to step back and think about how little we really knew at the beginning of the pandemic compared to where we are now. Mm-hmm. And when you mix all of those things together, the uncertainty, the unpredictability, the stress just in an acute sense of the pandemic, Foxman said that's really just the perfect recipe for anxiety. And you throw in related lockdowns as well, some of the ways that people usually de-stress from anxiety in their day-to-day lives, they simply weren't available anymore.
Mm. And you mentioned children. How were they affected by all of this?
Yeah, and this sort of gets into the other piece I wrote about the surge in eating disorders as well. But really, for them, Foxman made the point that often people that are no longer in school think about school in that K through 12 range as an educational institution. He said for kids, it's more of a social institution.
Yeah.
That's how they view it.
Yeah.
And so not being able to see their friends is one part of it. Some kids who were already outgoing were able to do okay. That's one of the points that Julie Balaban made. And if they already had groups of friends and they were already in Snapchat and Instagram group messages, they could keep in touch that way. But for kids who were already maybe a little more on the fringes there, this was a very, very hard time, and it was harder for them to stay in touch. For a kid that isn't naturally outgoing, it could be hard to just send that text and reach out to someone that maybe you don't know all that well, let alone organize a way to see each other in a remote, safe, distanced type of environment there.
Boy, in that perspective of kids thinking of school in a more social context, I think at the end of every summer, my feelings of going back to school were not, oh, great, I get to go back and learn again, as opposed to I get to go back and see all the kids who I haven't seen all summer. So I want to, one thing that's really near and dear to me is the 251 Club, and you found a couple who embrace this. Tell us about the 251 Club and these people.
Absolutely. So this was also something that was necessitated by pandemic lockdowns in a way. I was speaking with David Ziedler, who's an Essex resident, and he and his girlfriend, who had only been dating for a couple of months when lockdowns happened, they're both in the restaurant industry, and so they found themselves off work for basically a good month with all this time on their hands. And it's sort of funny, I was speaking with Boxman as well, who mentioned the relationship problems, the uptick in relationship problems from people kind of being constrained in that smaller environment, having to stay home all the time. He shared an anecdote from a friend of his who's married and had to and was working from home. He said his wife told him, "I married you for better or for worse, not for lunch." So he used that as an example of kind of the way that the conflicts, you know, can arise. Mm-hmm. Ziedler said that indeed his Essex apartment was getting a little cabin fevery, so they had to look for something to do. They ended up deciding to see how many towns they could tick off on the 251 Club, which is, for those that don't know, a group that encourages Vermonters to visit all 251 of the state's towns and cities. They made it to all but two, but not for a lack of ambition. It was a lack of their vehicles' ability to traverse some of the service roads, which as people know, can get pretty difficult. So yes. I think Google Maps sent them down maybe the wrong trail one day, and they said, you know what, we're going to come back to it. But for them, it was just a great way to get out and see parts of the state that, although they've been living here for a few years, had never seen before. Ziedler's originally from Connecticut. He's lived here for about 9 years. And for him, it's just, it's totally opened his eyes to some of the underrated and beautiful, unknown parts of the state. So they'd pack a lunch, pack the car, and see how many they could hit, stop for lunch, and then drive home.
Beautiful. And that is the whole idea behind the 251 Club. Seamus, those who treat patients with eating disorders, how much has their client load increased during the pandemic?
Yeah, Rick, this is one where Vermont is not an exception to a national trend and a national story. The experts that I spoke to across the country are qualitatively reporting as many as 2 to 3 times as many people reporting to outpatient clinics with severe eating disorders. Unfortunately, we don't know specifically how many more eating disorders have been logged during the pandemic. All the experts I spoke to also noted that the studies done and the data kept by people in the U.S. Are pretty inadequate in terms of tracking incidence and prevalence of eating disorders. So it's hard to say on that end, but we know qualitatively anyone that's involved with an outpatient clinic that treats eating disorders, they're overwhelmed right now.
Well, how have these clinics been handling this increased caseload?
It's been hard. In some cases, it means longer wait times for people that need treatment. We know there's a shortage on hospital beds. There's a shortage of spots to be treated at clinics run by hospitals or adjacent to hospitals. And there's a shortage of outpatient care facilities like the Adams Center in South Burlington. I spoke with Sue Adams, who's the founder and clinical director there. Her wait list for treatment there, and I should mention that they don't treat exclusively eating disorders, but it is a big part of what they do. That wait list had grown to 70 before she actually took it offline in order to give her a chance to actually bring on more providers with specialties in treating eating disorders. And that's on top of the 200 unique patients they already treat each week. So now that more people have been brought on, Adams did say that wait list is going to be opening back up again. But that number is still very high, and it's going to take time for people to actually get the help that they need.
Wow, those are staggering numbers, Seamus. What are the causes or stressors that have been affecting these eating disorders?
The consensus seems to be that it's the overwhelming stress, uncertainty, and unpredictability brought on by the pandemic and the shutdowns. That pretty much is viewed as the main thing driving the surge in new eating disorders, as well as the worsening of pre-existing ones. A study conducted last July, which is really the main one that the experts I spoke to have been cited, that reported that 62% of respondents with anorexia already experienced a worsening of their symptoms. I spoke with Cynthia Bullock, who's the director of the Eating Disorder Center at the University of North Carolina. she's one of the people who co-authored that study, who said that the people that they spoke with really reported three major reasons. And it was a lack of social support, living in a triggering environment, and a lack of structure to their days. And all of those factors for people either with eating disorders already or concurrent anxiety disorders, obsessive compulsive disorder, that's really a recipe for either worsening symptoms or developing new ones. Another point where there's less immediate evidence, but something that was floated as well by the people I talked to, was food insecurity. We might remember at the beginning of the pandemic, there were some fears over the disruption of the food supply itself. Yeah. There was the ad taken out by Tyson Foods in the New York Times, and I believe a couple other papers as well, that warned that the food supply in the food chain could be crumbling or on the verge of crumbling. And for people with binge or stockpiling behaviors, that sort of insecurity can be triggering for them as well.
And yeah, food insecurity, a big issue, probably still up through today, but it was really pointed. We got a really great picture of it when the food box program started, and hundreds of cars showed up at the Berlin airport for those food boxes. Really kind of staggering to see the photos from that day. What you mentioned anorexia, Seamus, what type of eating disorders have people been experiencing?
Sure. So there are the three most common types of eating disorders. You have anorexia nervosa is the full name. That's characterized by excessive dieting and fasting and or overexercise. Usually you need the abnormally low body weight as well to be diagnosed with that type of eating disorder. There's bulimia nervosa, which is characterized by periods of binge eating, usually followed by some sort of purge, either by forced vomiting, fasting, or overexercise. And then there's binge eating disorder itself, someone who routinely eats excessive amounts of food in a short period. Anorexia nervosa tends to be less common overall as the entire picture. However, it was anorexia nervosa that saw the highest increase in incidence cases during the pandemic.
Have there been specific age groups that have been most affected?
Hard to say whether certain age groups have been most affected. And certainly anyone is vulnerable to an eating disorder. I think there's still sort of a problematic idea or stigma as anorexia as a women's disease, or more specifically a white women's disease. And while it's true that women make up the vast majority of diagnoses in anorexia specifically, something about 85%, it's extremely important when we're talking about clinical diagnoses such as this, that we realize that's by no means determinant, and that this is something that can affect anyone. However, there certainly is a unique impact to younger individuals as well. The experts that I spoke to talked about how so many children when they at the beginning of the pandemic were reporting that's when the eating disorder, tangential or adjacent behavior really began. And it was a mix of wanting to make sure that they stayed fit while that they were at home during lockdown. They were picking up exercise, and many wanted to go on a diet as well. And while dieting for some people in some cases can certainly be healthy, it definitely isn't for everyone. And excessive dieting certainly isn't for anyone. You mix overexercise with extreme fasting, and that can lead to some severe problems. And that seemed to be what was happening for a lot of kids at the beginning of the pandemic.
When I asked you about causes or stressors, one that you listed was triggering situations. What kind of unhealthy situations did the lockdown create or recreate for some people?
For some people that have home environments that are less healthy or dysfunctional, it can be triggering to be locked down in that type of environment. So people that had to return to living either with people in which they had unhealthy relationships or just a situation that was unhealthy and stressful, that can play into worsening of symptoms or the developing of new ones. And also, for younger teens as well, and people going through adolescence, the experts that I spoke to, mentioned how adolescence, it's really a normal time for conflict with parents. Kids are individuating, they're developing a sort of self-awareness. And so tensions can already be pretty high with parents. There's a degree to which that's just natural. That's part of growing up. That's just the adolescent process. But when there's really no escape from that, when it's possible to sort of get out from under that roof in a safe way, it can be very difficult.
Wow. Now, both of these stories, you did great research about the effects of the pandemic. Are people starting to readjust, fall back into the lives that they had back in February of 2020?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that's going to take some time as well. We're not quite out of the woods yet. So depending on, you know, how the next few months go, how the variants go, maybe we'll see. It seems as though there are cases, right, where you have a minority of people that have changed in radical ways, and then you have a majority of people that have changed in smaller ways. I think there's going to be a greater awareness of mental health. People are on the lookout for these sorts of things now. The pandemic, when it first struck, really exposed so many inequities across our society, across access to healthcare, across access to resources. And I think as, so long as we are diligent about maintaining that awareness, I think it's possible that in some ways we are better off. But still, that feels sort of ridiculous to say, when we're talking about a disease that has killed 600,000, Americans. It's been necessitated by such a trauma. If people slow down, though, a little bit, if people, as Dr. Foxman was saying, realize that maybe they could do with a little bit less, incorporate more mindfulness techniques into their routines, maybe that could be a good thing, though.
Excellent. Seamus McAvoy, reporter for VT Digger. You can find these stories at vtdigger.org. Seamus, it was great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Rick. My pleasure.
All right. Quick CBS News update. Then we'll be back to chat with a Vermonter who has made the U.S. Olympic team in rugby sevens. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I've mentioned before that Vermont doesn't produce a ton of summer Olympians. As a matter of fact, John Kerrigan, the Harwood Union High School cross-country coach, told me the other day that Albert Lovejoy Gutterson was the first and only Vermonter to win a gold medal at the Summer Olympics. It was in the 1912 Stockholm Games in the long jump. Gutterson was from Springfield, Vermont, and UVM's Fieldhouse is named for him. This summer in Tokyo, we have several Vermonters vying for gold. Ellie Puryear St. Pierre in the 1500 meters. Alona Marr of Burlington is competing in rugby sevens, and Alona Marr is with us now. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Alona a question or wish her luck in Japan, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You went to Burlington High School. What sports did you play there?
At Burlington, I played field hockey, basketball, and softball, and then senior year, I just kind of didn't want to do softball anymore, so I actually just took the short drive over to South Burlington and started playing for their club rugby team there.
Ah, so you did pick up rugby in high school. Of the sports you played in high school, which were you the best at?
I was pretty good at a lot of them, but I have to say, I think it was basketball. I loved basketball. I loved, I played, AAU basketball with Lone Wolf and all sorts around, and I would still say basketball is one of my favorite sports. Also loved field hockey. I was thinking of going to UVM to play field hockey. But it just kind of, I played rugby and it just automatically fit with my body type. So I was like, all right, I'm going to kind of go with this.
Well, you did choose Quinnipiac, not UVM, to attend. So why'd you pick that school?
Well, I was actually, I first picked, so I was already committed to UVM and was ready to go be in the nursing program. But I just remember, I was like, I don't want to be so close to home. I've driven past UVM my whole life, you know, a mile up the hill. And so I just was like, I want to go somewhere. So actually the Norwich coach first reached out to me for rugby because he's like, okay, this girl's pretty good. So I made the late decision to go to Norwich and played rugby there for a season. It just wasn't a good fit. And then I remember, well, I wanted to transfer and we played Quinnipiac and I did pretty well in that game. So I emailed the coach and was like, hey, you know, I'm this girl. I scored this many tries in your game. I would love to come and look at the school, and everything just worked out. And then I transferred and it was a great fit.
Yeah, and it's a great program at Quinnipiac. What did you study there?
I studied nursing, actually. So, I mean, it was tough, and it was a lot of, like, I had to do clinical hours and a lot of lectures, but it did mean missing practices at that time. But I'm so happy that I was able to graduate with my degree as well. So now, you know, whatever happens, I do have nursing to fall back on. So,
outstanding. Now, I'm sorry about this, Ilona, but I have to ask anyone who's ever lived close to New Haven, Connecticut, I want to know your pizza place of choice. Is it Frank Pepe's, Modern, Sally's, or somewhere else?
This is one of the better interview questions I've gotten. I am for sure a Modern fan.
No kidding.
I actually lived with my aunt and uncle for a summer, and Modern was where we went.
All right.
So hands down, I think New Haven Pizza is the best, but I think Modern is the best.
You're absolutely right. New Haven Pizza is the best. And I've always been a Frank Pepe fan. I'll try Modern next time I'm down there on your recommendation. Now, you decided to give rugby a try in high school. You played at Norwich. You went down to Quinnipiac. You did pretty well, the team there, while you were at Quinnipiac.
Yeah, we did. We ended up winning 3 national titles. And, you know, rugby is an emerging sport. We're really sport. We're trying to make it NCAA and fully supported by the school. And Quinnipiac does a great job of that. It's fully funded by the school. They give out athletic scholarships. So while there, we did a lot. And I think we gave great exposure to the game. And then personally, while there, I won, like, the M.A. Sorensen Award, which is the award for the best rugby player in the country. So It was a fruitful time at Quinnipiac for me.
So you're basically like the Heisman Trophy winner, if we can equate it to college football, Hobie Baker in college hockey. You won the equivalent in women's rugby.
That's what my mom would call it, yes.
Wow, well done. And playing at Quinnipiac, you played, it was the full 15-a-side rugby union?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, so tell people what it's like to have a ball thrown to you when none of your teammates can block and the defense comes charging at you. Your players have to get out of the way, right?
Yeah, so the big thing about rugby is that we can't pass forward. So you can only pass backwards. And really the way you make meters is by running it forward.
Right.
But people can tackle you. So you only can get tackled if you have the ball. And like in football, you're saying, you know, people can block, people can shove others off. Nobody can touch each other except for the people who are around, who have the ball.
Right.
So, and then unlike football, when a tackle is made, play continues. It's just a ruckus formed and people kind of compete over the ball, but the play continues, the ball is passed away, and it continues to play on.
Now, it looks like the most brutal sport in the world, and I follow it. I watch rugby union, I watch rugby league, I watch, you know, from Australia, England, I watch, you know, the all the international matches. It looks to me like one of the most brutal sports you can ever play. Yet I know, you know, people who have played, men and women, and they say, no, it's not that bad. Convince me of that.
It is so wild to me because, you know, a lot of people go to rugby who've never played a sport before, and they're like, let me try out this full contact sport. This will be the one for me. And I'm like, this is the one you chose? I think it's awesome, but it's wild. So rugby, I think the main thing is, you know, Americans love football. Football tackling is, I have trouble watching it, but it's such a different form. It's really, football is like, get him down however you can, whatever it means, even if it hurts your body.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think with rugby is we're taught how to tackle and taught really good tackling techniques so your head and your neck are protected. I mean, at times, yes, it does look like chaos. And I watched some of the MLR games we have in the U.S. And I'm like, holy crap, I couldn't even step on that field. But it is controlled, and it is like there's such a science and a way about it, I think, that mm-hmm. it's really not, the goal isn't to hurt them so much as like, it's just to get them down as quickly as possible in the most efficient way, but also so that you're able to still get up and play in the game.
And high tackles are always out of bounds. They're always outlawed, correct?
Yeah, so we like can't clothesline. You can't do anything above pretty much like chest up. So they definitely are cracking down on that. You'll get a yellow card, which is in 15s, you mean you sit in the sin bin for 10 mm-hmm. minutes. In 7s, you'll sit in the sin bin for 2 minutes. And in 7s, we play 14-minute games, tournament style, for like 6 games. So 2 minutes in a 14-minute game can be a lot.
Yeah.
And when you're down to 6 players versus 7 on a full pitch, you can feel the space.
Have you had any major injuries playing rugby?
I mean, yeah, and I think people ask me that, oh, rugby injuries, but it's really the same for any sport. Like, I think the injuries I've gotten, I could have gotten that in soccer. You know, a couple ankles and whatnot, but that's just, a lot of times it's not even in the tackle zone. It's just been me, like, trying to do a step, and I'm not a stepper, and then I do something to my ankle or something, and then, you know, I've just some other things, but with soccer and headers, like, I recently just was getting tackled, and I kind of got a little wrapped up and did a little head thing, but that's something like in soccer when you're doing a header. So if you look at our injury rates, it's nothing different than most other sports.
And Alona, you bring up soccer, the equipment you wear, you know, the uniform, isn't much different than what our soccer players are wearing, right?
Dare I say almost less, because they wear that tiny piece of plastic on their shins.
That's right. They
all we wear are cleats, and then we have mouth guards in.
Yeah.
And some people will wear scrum caps, but really scrum caps are more of a 15s item when you're in the scrum to stop your ears from moving back and forth. But in 7s, our scrums are very quick, and nothing really happens too much that would cause any trauma to your ears. So that's it, just the mouth guards.
Yeah, and some in the scrum will actually have, like, black electrical tape wrapped around their heads holding down their ears, right?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, one, style, and then two, also just to stop your ears from being moved when you're shoving your head between two grown human size.
We're talking rugby, and
for sure rugby, yeah.
All right. As I mentioned, Alona, you're going for rugby sevens. You touched on some of the differences, obviously the number of players, but what are big differences between rugby union and sevens?
Yeah, so normal rugby is 15v15 for 80-minute games, 40-minute halves, played on a full pitch. And then we do 7v7 for 14-minute games, for still played on a full pitch. So you have so much more space. It's such a faster game.
Yep.
A lot less rucks and scrums. It's just a lot more scoring. It's all the same rules, pretty much. Like, you know, if a ball is knocked on or knocked forward, we'll play a scrum, which is where you compete over the ball. If the ball goes out, we'll do a line out. But just every component of that has less players than a 15s game. So I think it makes it a great game for people to watch, and I'm excited for people to watch it this summer and see what fun it can be. Even if you don't really get rugby, you'll think it's interesting.
Yeah, it never stops. It's wicked fast. And you're fast. What position do you play in sevens?
I am surprisingly fast. So I play either a center or a prop. So your prop will be usually the bigger girls who'll be playing in the scrum, and they're the ones who are going to compete for the ball, and they're the ones who lift in the line out. They can also be fast, and then I play center, which is more your playmaker, fast person. But what's special about sevens is that really everybody kind of plays every position at some time, whereas in 15s, your scrum half is just going to be your scrum half. They're going to be really the only person who takes that ball out of the scrum, mm-hmm. out of the rucks. But in 15s, it's a really free-flowing game, so sometimes your prop can end up on the wing or sometimes be in the middle. So it's really, you play anywhere.
When did you make that transition from 15s to 7s and say, whoa, this is my sport? I like rugby, but this.
Yeah. I never really, I think it was just, it's always kind of like been there as like a type of rugby that I have played a little bit of. So I played a little bit at Norwich. They did a good amount in the spring season. And then at Quinnipiac, we did a couple of sevens tournaments, but I never thought anything of it. And then my senior year, I was like, you know what, maybe, just maybe I could go on with this rugby thing. And so I played for a high level club team. Well, I played in the summer for a club team in New York, and that was a really fun time to kind of experience what social rugby was. But then after I was done playing for Quinnipiac, I was like, well, I kind of want to maybe go for the USA team. So I played high level club and went to tournaments in New York and Barbados and Vegas and kind of really showed out there and grabbed the attention of the USA team, and then went to a camp in Sydney in January. And then a week after I graduated college, I had went out to California and started training with the USA team.
So is right now nursing on hold, and the full focus has been on rugby for you?
Yeah, nursing's on hold. I mean, I remember asking my nurse professors, I asked my mom, I'm like, well, you know, should I do this? Should I go for this? And they're like, well, there's always going to be hospitals. There's always going to be people who need nurses, but there's not always going to be this chance to go to the Olympics. And I was like, okay, you're right. So nursing's really on hold right now. I would want to give it my full attention, and I have still so much to learn there. Mm-hmm. But right now I want to focus on being, I guess, the best rugby player I can be. And I don't think I can do that by also trying to be the best nurse I can be.
What was the process to get selected for this Olympic team?
Yeah, so unlike for our other teams, it's like our team qualified in 2019. We placed second in the world in 2019, so we got an automatic spot. But the players who are on that team don't get an automatic spot. For every tournament, we get chosen again. So every tournament, a new 12 is chosen by our management team. So I've made every tournament since, but I never like to get too confident. But our team was released to us after training for a year on June 3rd of the 12 girls who will be going to represent the USA.
Oh, congratulations. What does it mean for you, Ilona, to be representing the U.S. in Tokyo?
It's just a huge honor. I think anybody who's ever played a sport in their life has thought slightly about the Olympics. Even if it was just t-ball, you were like, wait a second, maybe I could do the Olympics because it's such a cool thing. And I mean, I've thought about the Olympics for field hockey, and I've thought about it for basketball and all this stuff. And so it's just an honor to represent my family and show them that all the hard work they did for me, and I'm trying to pay it forward for them. And then just to show all my coaches, the community, even Burlington, Vermont, like what one of their own is doing, and show what can be done. And just to wear the red, white, and blue out there is going to be just amazing. I'm so excited to rip the emblem.
Yeah. People should, when you're online, you know, look for YouTube clips of Ilona Maher, and it's M-A-H-E-R. You will be so impressed to see her just tearing down the field and playing for the U.S. Now, a lot of people also ask Ilona about rugby sevens in the Summer Olympics. It has a little bit of history, but not a long history in the Olympics.
Yeah, so it really, the first time, it was in like 1920-something or something like that, but then rugby got taken out of the Olympics. And so the first time it was back in was in Rio 4-5 years ago. So this will only be the second time rugby sevens is in the Olympics. And it'll be played over three-day tournaments. So the men will play first, and then we'll play I'm pretty sure the 28th to like the 31st or something like that. Three-day tournaments, 2 games a day. And the last time the gold was won by Australia, but I think we do have a good chance. We're bringing a really solid squad, so I'm excited to see what happens.
Who are the top squads? You mentioned Australia, the U.S. What are the other countries that really compete well in women's rugby sevens?
Yeah, so New Zealand, of course. They grow up having this rugby mindset, and they have the All Blacks, so they're a great team. Actually, a lot of teams have just been coming up recently. Canada's a great team, France, Russia. What's been interesting is usually every season we play these teams like 8 times a season. So we get to know them. We know how they play. So in COVID, we haven't played these teams at all. I haven't played New Zealand, Australia, the top competitors. So going to the Olympics will be the first time playing them in a year and a half. So it'll just be through research that we've done from some of their past games or what they do that weekend. And they don't, you know, they kind of have seen how we play, but everything's changed. So it's going to be definitely interesting to see how it goes.
Now, when the women's sevens from New Zealand line up, do they do the haka like the men's 15s?
So the 15s players, the men do it before their game.
Yeah.
The sevens teams, women and men, will do it after the tournament just because they play six games in a tournament.
Oh, right.
So they'll do their haka afterwards. You know, hopefully if they win a medal, then they'll have a smile on their face. But I'm hoping that we might stop that one in their tracks, so we can win the medal.
All right. And again, that's another thing people can look up. It is truly one of the most inspiring things in sports, is to see the All Blacks do the haka before a rugby match. Now, you mentioned that the pandemic didn't allow you to play a lot against the Australians, the New Zealands. What has been going on with the team, you know, in this past year and a half?
Yeah, so I went home actually for 4 months. I went home and lived with my family, and it was a great time. But I didn't really play any rugby besides passing the ball with my dad in the driveway.
Hmm.
I did get to work out. I worked out with my strength coach, Joey Basil, at Premier Strength Performance on Shelburne Road. But other than that, it was just kind of like I didn't get to do my job really. And then we got back here around August. And it's just been a lot of training, a lot of inter-squad scrimmages. We were able to do a tournament in Spain, a tournament in Dubai, but it's been a lot of training is all I can really say.
And, you know, leading up to things like World Cup, et cetera, there's friendly matches. Do you have any coming up before the Olympics that will get you ready for the competition there?
Actually, this past weekend, a couple of days ago, we were just playing in L.A., and Great Britain came, and we played them, I think, four times.
Wow.
So that was really good. It's just, you know, in COVID, we these tournaments are set up, but depending on a lot of things, teams have to pull out or they can't get in. So it's really always a guessing game of who's actually going to come to a tournament. Thankfully, we did get Great Britain, and it was great competition between them because they're also an Olympic side. So, but that was really our warm-up, and now we're just like, all right, ready to go play New Zealand. And in Tokyo, our pool is going to be Australia, Japan, and China.
All right. Well, best of luck with that. We have about a minute left. What would you say, Alona, to convince other women or girls to take up this sport?
I think the key thing for me is the amount of confidence in myself and my body that I've gotten from this sport. This sport accepts all body types, really, and I just feel like so it's created me and turned me into such an empowered, strong woman that it looks like a brutal, fun sport, but I think anybody would try it, and there's a place for anybody out there. And it just shows you what your body's really capable of. And I think it can really be beneficial for young girls, old girls, anybody. So I would definitely give it a try.
Alona Maher is a member of the U.S. Olympic team competing in Tokyo in rugby sevens. Alona, good luck to you and your teammates in Japan, and thanks so much for being on the program this morning.
Thank you for having me.
All right, take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan and is produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Willow Zartarian. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free, suggest topics or guests. We'd love to hear from you. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The WDEV podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri, off for the next couple of days, so I'll meet you back here on Monday.